Hey everyone, this is Yannick Silver, and I'm really excited for another Maverick Business Insider interview. I got with me one of my buddies, Drew Kossoff, Drew Clutch Kossoff, and I'll talk about that in a second. So I've known Drew for, Drew, how many years has it been now? Like eight, maybe? Seven?
Could be, yeah, probably.
It's been a while. I first met Drew through Evan, but maybe it might have been, I think it's the reverse.
I think it's through Craig Clemens, actually.
Okay, yeah, so Craig Clemens, part of, used to be through the Evan Pagan circle, and then Drew was really one of the guys responsible for driving Evan's business to beyond pay-per-click and really buying just general advertising and really blowing up what they were doing in the dating space. And then since that time, he's gone on and does media buying for a whole host of kind of who's who of internet marketers. And that's kind of where we wanted to focus on today. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for people to get beyond maybe some of the traditional places where they can advertise or they originally think about, whether it's just pay-per-click or possibly now Facebook advertising, and really get into a spot where not many people, you know, kind of understand it, but it's something that can really blow up their business if they do it right. So, Drew, can you give a little bit of a background on yourself, if you can, and then we'll get into that.
Sure. So I actually have been doing online marketing for 20 years now.
Wow.
It started way back when in 1991, the summer of 91, where I did a professional residency at Prodigy, which back then was the internet. It was Prodigy, AOL, and CompuServe were the three sort of online services before sort of the free web existed. That was the early days of online direct marketing, and I was really interested in and excited about, you know, the internet and online marketing, and have been doing it ever since. And that was when I was getting my master's degree in direct marketing at the time, and I just saw the applications for direct marketing, which, you know, previously were more, you know, direct mail and catalogs and sort of you know, offline media, and I saw the potential for online very early, and pursued it, and here I am 20 years later, you know, a primarily direct response advertising guy. Most, you know, there's sort of two sides of the coin with advertising. There's branding, which are sort of the big corporate clients that aren't necessarily on their media spend, and then there's the rest of us sort of in our world where you're trying to sell something and make a return, and that's where I mostly focus. And over the years, I've you know, worked with Evan Pagan and helped him grow his business to the $20 million a year level and beyond, and, you know, a whole host of other businesses of my own and of clients that have grown to the seven-figure level, and primarily through media buying and traffic generation. So,
you know, the way I always look at it is that, you know, there's push and pull kind of advertising, right? So, so pull is kind of pay-per-click, where somebody types in, you know, I'm looking for, I don't know, volleyball lessons, right? So then you'll advertise on there if you have volleyball training or lessons for sale. But at the same time, there's a whole host of sites where people can, who volleyball players probably congregate, and they may or may not be looking for volleyball lessons at that time, but if you threw up a banner or a text link or, you know, some of the other ways that you've integrated media buying, then they might be like, oh, yeah, I am interested in getting training on, you know, playing better volleyball. So that's the push strategy.
That's correct. I think of it a little bit differently, or maybe I sort of speak in terms that maybe anyone who's done some pay-per-click would be familiar with, and that's, in my mind, one is search, where someone's searching for something, they're actively seeking, you know, I want volleyball lessons or volleyball, you know, equipment.
Right.
And the other person happens to be a volleyball player, but they're not searching for it. They just happen to be on a volleyball blog or a volleyball site, and they, you know, and it's more like interruption marketing, where they're doing something else, but they've, you know, that they're your, you know, the right demographic or the right target, and you're trying to persuade them or interrupt them from what they're doing to click on your banner or your text link or your, you know, whatever your messaging is. You could, you know, you could even be inside email.
Right.
To get them to over to your site and your offer and get them into your funnel.
Right, and then even probably a more advanced, and maybe we'll jump into that, is at some point, is not only just the volleyball blogs where, you know, they congregate, but you've figured out almost I don't know, places that they might be, even though it's not a typical spot. So you're
100% accurate. That's sort of the in fact, that's kind of the area that I really specialize in. Over the last couple of years, I've really realized my whole philosophy is if you don't have a competitive advantage, don't compete. That comes from Jack Welch of GE. That's sort of one of his quotes that I live by. And you know, it's very competitive to advertise in certain spaces. Search is very competitive, but where there's really big opportunities is what I call lateral marketing, where you're right, that you can find your audience in places that have nothing to do with volleyball, for example. There maybe volleyball players are also swimmers, or volleyball players like to travel to certain destinations. You might be able to find volleyball players on a travel site or on a bathing suit site or whatever it is.
Right.
And finding those lateral sites where you can convert the customers very often are much cheaper than to buy advertising on. There's a lot of competition on the keywords and the search for a certain category, but there's not as much competition in a lateral site, and because it maybe isn't in that niche, it can very often be far less costly. So even if the conversion's not as good, if the price per click is 15 cents instead of 70 cents, even if you're only getting a 5% opt-in rate instead of a 15 or whatever the numbers your business require, you can often still be profitable. And there's going lateral is just this huge opportunity for growing a business beyond just within your niche.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think you told me, what I mentioned at the beginning was Drew Clutch cuss off was because you were on the very first Maverick Business Adventures trip that we went Baja off-road racing, and I don't think you drove Clutch for maybe 10 years before that. And so we were giving you a hard time, especially on the hills where you were where there might be one or two stalls, and everyone was enjoying that. But one of the things that I remember you talked about to the group was I'm pretty sure you mentioned it there, or I've heard you say it before, is that all media is good media, depending on how much you buy it for.
Yeah, I mean, true. If you're looking at an ROI, it doesn't matter what high-quality, very targeted traffic source could be very expensive but could work. Similarly, a very cheap, low-quality traffic source could work as long as it's hitting your profit margins that you require. And it really doesn't matter. And I have... I've got clients they're really successful clients where I'm scaling them, in many directions, from pay-per-click, display media, email traffic. The conversions vary significantly, depending on the media, and the prices vary significantly, but ultimately it's the bottom line that matters. So, you don't just look at a metric and go, "Oh, the opt-in rate is poor. It's not working." It's what's the bottom line? And in order to know the bottom line, tracking is really, really important. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges a lot of people have, is they don't have visibility, they don't have the right tracking in place, so they don't really know what a customer's worth to them. And if you can't track that all the way through the back end, then you're just guessing. And there's plenty of people who've grown big businesses without using a fudge factor, but the better your tracking is and your analytics are, the more successful you're going to be at media buying, because ultimately that's how you optimize. You pull the levers by saying what's working, what are the hot spots or sweet spots, and turn those up, and you definitely want to be turning off or turning down the ones that aren't working. That's how sort of bid management works. And it's almost like, I know a guy who's a commodities trader, and he said that the biggest thing that people lose most of their money on is the downside, not the upside. It's not about how much money you make; it's about how reducing your losses, and focusing on getting those things turned off, stop losses as quickly as possible, because you can lose your shirt, and it's so much harder to get it back than it is to just make small profit margins. And I think it's the same with advertising. The real sweet spots come, or the real profit comes, when you're able to look at your campaigns and go, "Oh, wow! One particular site or one particular keyword or whatever it is spending a ton of money and it's losing a huge amount. We need to turn that off." And boom! Now you're all of a sudden the campaign is profitable. And if you don't have visibility into that, you're just flying blind, and you're not looking at the numbers the way you need to. Because a lot of times, it's just incremental changes that make the big difference between profit and loss.
That's a great, great example. Let's talk about maybe, you know, without revealing names or industries, but I think, you know, I love hearing kind of how you scale up a business.
Okay.
And actually, maybe before we do that, what businesses or what marketplaces do you think work best for, you know, what you do or buying media in, you know, in a higher quantity than just the ceiling that's available in period?
Good question, because, you know, it's interesting. One of my early businesses that I actually started with Evan Pagan was in the wedding niche.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges we had was at wedding, it's a very small niche, even though there's a big market and it's a $1 billion industry. It's, you know, there's only 2 million weddings a year in the U.S., and you can't do mass marketing because, you know, in any given pool of people, it's only a small percentage of them that are engaged in planning a wedding.
Right.
Versus something like a diet product or a business opportunity product or, you know, any number of products that have more of a mass market, those are the ones that have the biggest opportunity to scale because you can do both the, you know, targeted advertising as well as broad advertising and often reach people almost anywhere, you know, not almost anywhere, but, you know, in a lot of places that have nothing to do with that niche, and that's where you can really scale. So
if I have what would be considered a niche product, is it, you said there are still opportunities, but it's just not as broad. Like, you know, maybe the wedding one's a good example because, like you said, there's only a certain amount of women who are ever interested in weddings because their radar's up to that because they're having a wedding, but otherwise.
Yeah, so it's like you can't do a general consumer email blast or you can't advertise on, you know, on a news site, you know, or something that's just sort of broad. Whereas you could advertise a diet product on a news site. You could advertise, you know, how to make money product on a news site. You could advertise a whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of things, teeth whitening and things that sort of apply to everybody. Everybody would like white teeth. Everybody would like to be skinny. Everybody would like to make more money. So those kind of products can have much, much more scalable opportunities from an advertiser.
So those are the ones that you look for right now if you're going to...
Those are those are the opportunities that we have the ability to help, you know, help clients scale. And then so speaking of sort of scaling, you know, there are many different ways to do it. If you've got endless amounts of money, you can, you know, sort of go big very fast. But typically, most people, even people who get direct response, who have the tracking, who want to grow fast, they don't want to lose a ton of money, and it requires some investment. Or, you know, to figure out what's going to work. You don't make money day one with media. You make an investment, you know, and like I said, cut out the fat and then focus on what's working. And so typically, you know, we'll start out in the most targeted places. Obviously, pay-per-click and Google are fantastic, you know, high-volume traffic sources with very good traffic and very good tracking. But then, you know, I think a lot of people, are, you know, that's all they do. I mean, 5 years ago when I spoke at Underground, I was talking about most people, you know, either all they do is pay-per-click or, you know, the majority of their media buying is pay-per-click. And there is, you know, you're leaving so much on the table or off the table if you're not looking at other traffic sources. And so, you know, in a typical model where we're scaling people, we'll start with some very targeted stuff, and once we know that's working and we understand the metrics of the business, and they've tweaked the landing pages and the offer, and if, you know, we feel like we've got the right offer, we can then, you know, sort of just, you know, every month add another traffic source, do another test, keep scaling, and a year down the road, all of a sudden, maybe we've tried 15 or 20 sources and maybe only 10 or 12 worked, but now you've got 10 different traffic sources and you're diversified and you have a solid, in a portfolio of traffic sources, so that if you get slapped by Google or you have, you know, something goes wrong with one source, you're not, your business isn't dead. You've got, you know, 9 others that are still working. And you know, I've had clients, you know, for example, you asked me, I'm not going to name the client or the niche,
yeah,
but you know, one client that we went from spending, you know, 6 figures a month to multiple 6 figures a month, and, you know, grew the business to $1 million a month in revenue, you know, just primarily through, you know, media buying and building a big list. And and, you know, when I started working with them, they were only doing pay-per-click on Google, and when we were finished, or not finished, we're still working together, it, you know, we had many, many different traffic sources. And like we talked about earlier, converting at very different, you know, at different conversion rates, different sources have, you know, have different metrics, but ultimately, as long as they work, you know, then it's a good thing. So
Maybe kind of take it step by step. So pay-per-click is probably the first source, and a lot of people have been using that. Where's the next spot that you typically
look at? Well, so, and I guess we shouldn't even define it just as pay-per-click. I mean, because there's actually different, you know, you can buy media on a CPM, CPA, CPC, and again, that doesn't even matter either. As long as the metrics work, I've got all, you know, I do all of the above. It just depends, mm-hmm. you know, how, you know, a lot of the people who do high-volume media buying buy CPMs, and which is more risk, but if you're doing a lot of testing and you have the ability to test, you know, dozens and dozens of banners and test the offers and test the pages a lot, you can actually end up getting, you know, a lower cost per click with a CPM buy than you can buying pay-per-click. So,
and define CPM for people.
So with a CPM, you're paying for every 1,000 times your ad shows up, for, you know, per 1,000 impressions, they call it. And those, you pay whether anyone clicks or buys or opts in regardless. If they display your ad 1,000 times, you're paying, you know, whatever. If it's a dollar CPM, then you're paying a dollar every time they show your ad 1,000 times. And so all the risk is on your side. You know, with pay-per-click, they could, you know, Google might have to show your ad 10,000 times to get someone to click, but you don't pay for the 10,000 impressions. You just pay for the one click. So there's less risk. You're only paying for an action. You know, then moving down the line, you can also do deals where you're paying for not just a click, but you're actually paying for an opt-in or paying for a sale. And so maybe you're paying, you know, 50 cents a click on a CPC, but maybe you can buy you can pay $3 a lead for an opt-in, or you can pay $40 a sale for a sale. And there's various different ways to negotiate those kind of deals with different partners. And so the more you can take the risk away from you and put it onto the publishers, it's usually better for clients. But again, if you've got the ability, to pull the levers and really do a lot of testing, then sometimes it's worth the risk to keep it on your side.
Got it.
So sorry. So going back to traffic sources, I mean, the big ones right now are Google, still Google, and of course Facebook has come out of nowhere to be, you know, a huge traffic source. 5 years ago you couldn't advertise on Facebook,
right?
And today it's it's as much volume as Google in most cases. And their targeting is fantastic on Facebook, but Google and Facebook are also very different animals. Facebook, because it's a membership site, and they don't want you showing the same ads over and over and over again to the same people. They deliberately fatigue your ads, and so over time, your ads will not get the same results, and you have to basically refresh them and reinvent your campaigns over and over and over again to keep your traffic consistent. Whereas with Google, once you kind of optimize and get a campaign working, you can kind of expect similar, you know, traffic day in and day out for, you know, with just maintenance, as opposed to Facebook. It's just a constant reinvention, and so it's a bit more work. And ultimately, media buying is not rocket science. You know, anybody listening to this, or reading this, this interview, can do the Facebook and Google stuff on their own. But it ultimately, scaling to the big levels, just you need someone focused on it, 24/7, looking at the numbers every day. And it's just a lot of it's a lot of time and energy to keep it on track. And so I think when doing a little bit on your own to start your business out is, not a big deal, but when you really want to get to the next level, unless you want to do it full-time, all day long, it's probably better to have someone like me who can sort of manage it for you. And so then going beyond pay-per-click, and sort of self-service platforms where you kind of log in and manage it yourself, there's the opposite extreme is going to the big ad networks and letting them sort of manage it for you, kind of managed accounts, and we're talking big dollars where you have to spend anywhere from $10,000 to $25,000 just to do a test, just to see if it's going to work. And then once you've sort of gotten proof of concept, you can scale beyond that. But most people are not willing to spend $10,000-$20,000 just to see if it's going to work.
Right.
And so that's sort of the next level. And then everywhere in between, you can do individual buys with directly with websites. You can buy on the ad networks. You can buy on various platforms. You can buy PPV. You can buy email. And you don't need to do all the above. And it really just depends on the industry you're in and the niches you're in and where the right target sites are. But there's endless amounts of media beyond Google, and it's definitely worthwhile pursuing more than one traffic source and diversifying.
Do you think self-serve ad networks, kind of like AdBrite, and I'm sure there's some others, are worth testing as your next level?
You know, I'm not a big fan of AdBrite. I used to be many years ago, but I haven't had great results of them, you know, in recent years. But again, it depends on what, you know, every network has its sort of its specialties and niches, and depending on what kind of product you have or you're promoting, any network could work for you. Each one is different. So,
are there any self-serve ones that are kind of good stepping stones to jump into, maybe some banner traffic or linking or links that would make sense?
Well, you know, it's one thing that a lot of people, I'm still amazed that people don't take advantage of is, you know, is just even Google's content and display network. From a banner perspective, there's huge volume there, and a lot of people, you know, are just, I don't know how to get banners made, or I don't understand display, you know, but there's, you know, at the simplest level for a beginner, you know, that's a great way to start with display media and to test different ads, and then when you're ready to take it to, you know, to display networks or to directly to sites that want banners, you can, you know, have already tested which ones were performed best, and
that's a good one. What have you found on banners that make sense or that you've been surprising to you that always works? I mean, things like,
you know, what's been surprising to me is actually that homemade banners often work as well as slick, beautifully created, you know, banners by designers. So, I mean, I have a professional designer that creates banners for me, but I also make my own. And
yeah,
in many cases, it's the, you know, putting a handwriting font with your, you know, with your own, you know, just a plain background. And, you know, it's I guess what I'd say is that the message is the most important thing, not the how, you know, slick it looks. And if you have, and one of the simplest ways to translate from, if you've already been doing pay-per-click and you know what sort of messaging works, you know, in your text ads, is simply to make banners of your text ads. Take the exact copy that's in your text ad and make it into a banner, and you don't need any graphics or images or anything. It's the message that matters most, you know. And then if you want to play around later on with adding images and you know, and flash and you know.
Right,
more dynamic kind of stuff. You know, you can do that, but you know, at the simplest level, you can literally make it in Photoshop and it's make a static ad with the same messaging you have in your text ads, and maybe put it in a handwriting font or just something very clear and big. Because the cool thing about banners is they give you more real estate, so you can take a little tiny text ad message and make it bigger. You know, and if you know that a certain question or a certain headline is gets people to click, it's going to work the same way in banners. So,
and then, even putting things like click here, does that still work?
Oh, definitely want to have a call to action. That's a big mistake a lot of people don't do is, you know, for me, it's typically the bottom right corner, and it's a click here, or watch now, or whatever it is that you're trying to get them to do, you know, and that sometimes make that, you know, if you've got a designer who can help you with this, you can make that, you know, flash or, you know, animate that some way, you know, have little arrows pointing or whatever it is. You know, anything you can do to get the click through up. Is gonna help your cause.
Excellent. Okay, so that's one spot that we can look at. Is certainly the Google Content Network. That makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, you were talking about testing out different traffic sources per month. What else should people kind of look at or should get on their radar?
So, I mean, like I said, there's many different traffic sources. So I wouldn't try all, you know, to go to 10 different traffic sources in a given month. I would do one by one. It doesn't have to be in a month. It could be one a week, one a month, one every 3 months, depending on your budget and your business. But ultimately, you want to constantly be testing new sources. And it takes a little bit of money to do the testing. And very often, like I said, what I tend to do is more of a shotgun approach. So someone who is really frugal and doesn't have a lot of money to burn and really wants to be profitable from day one, you know, might do things differently and start, you know, spend very small and cap their daily spends to, you know, small amounts and grow very slowly. I tend to have clients who want to grow, grow faster, and so, you know, within reason. But, you know, the more testing you're doing and the more things you're trying to figure out, the more money you need to spend for the test to be statistically significant. So, and then also, like I said, to cut out the fat. So, you know, if you say, okay, I'll spend $500 a day for a week or a month, whatever the timeline is, you know, day one, you're not going to have enough data if you're testing a lot of different traffic sources or a lot of different sites within the site, you know, the campaign that you're running. You're going to need to spend a few thousand bucks just to figure out, okay, wow, now I've got enough data on all, you know, on the 40 sites I'm targeting on this campaign. You know, wow, 25 of them are just, you know, not working, but wow, I found five that are just killing it. You know, now I'm going to focus on those. Maybe I'll raise the bids. Maybe I'll, you know, when, and then boom, you turned off the 25 that aren't working. You've got the ones that are working, and you scale them, and they're profitable, and it's great. So now you've got a new channel that works, and you recoup the losses from the first week or two. By the end of the month, then boom, month number two, you're in the black, and you're rolling, and you just drop that winner into your portfolio, and now you do it again. You rinse and repeat, and every month you keep doing that. And so I think that's one of the biggest mistakes a lot of people make, is that they get scared off by, you know, a loss, losing a little money up front, and they just quit and say, you know, they give up. And the people who succeed and, you know, are the ones who stick with it, keep testing. It's all about testing, and make it work. I mean, I've had campaigns where it took $25,000 to get it to work, you know, and if they'd quit after 10 or after 15 or after 20 and said, oh, it's not working, you know, they would have walked away. But next thing you know, we're spending $150,000 a month on the campaign, because once we got it working, it was a great traffic source. It just took some time and some money and some tweaking to get it to work. Not the average person can't do that, but that's what, you know, that's sort of this part of the secret sauce is really the testing and sticking with it. And sometimes traffic sources won't work. Sometimes you just can't, you know, the prices are too high or the quality is too low. But in many cases, if you do enough testing and stick with it, and you know it's a big traffic source, you can, you know, it's worth it because the potential is there to really scale big once you get it working.
How do you, you know, it brings up a good point. So how do you know, you know, when's it time to cut that traffic source, or when's it time to keep, you know, putting in an investment?
Well, you know, so it depends on a client's understanding of their business. So, for example, the client that I was able to scale that I was describing just a second ago,
right,
they really understood their metrics. They, you know, they could see that, you know, maybe on, you know, week one they were only making back 50% of what they were spending. Week two they were making back, you know, 70%. Week three, you know, 85%. You know, and it was like we kept getting closer to break even, you know, where they wanted to be. And so we saw the improvement, and even though it was at a loss, they saw that, you know, if we could just get to a certain point, it's going to be a win.
Right.
I've had other people who are where, you know, we went down that road, and just from day one, the numbers were so far off that they said, even if we double or triple the conversions, we're still not going to be where we need to be. You know, and they, in that scenario, you know, they just said, you know, we're going to give up because we're going to cut it off because we just can't even foresee it getting close to being a win. So I think that's where you got to look at the metrics and say, you know, will an incremental increase, you know, improvement get us where we need to go, or is it going to be a monumental, you know, gap and that we just can't overcome? And so that's kind of how you determine. But if you see the potential, as you know, doing a lot of testing on the copy and on the pricing and on the landing pages can have, you know, significant increases in conversion. And if you're confident in your skills, you can get there.
So really, I mean, there's probably a couple factors, right? So it's not even just the ad buys that you can make, but then it really looks at a holistic point of, can we add an upsell or some sort of increase the transaction value? Can we, you know, what else is on the back end that we can add within 15 days or 30 days or whatever that then makes
absolutely
a lifetime value increase?
And it's, which is interesting, because, you know, but, you know, I've got a reputation. People say, oh, you know, they've heard about me and what I can, you know, the traffic that I generate or what I can do. But truthfully, I'm not a magician, and there's only so much. And I can negotiate great deals. I can find great, you know, I can do great targeting. I can find, you know, find you good traffic. But if your offer isn't, you know, is not strong or doesn't convert well, and you're not willing to test or change things, you know, in many cases, I'm not going to be able to make it work for you because I'm not a magician. You know, like, I could do the
right.
You know, I could send you great traffic, but if you're not willing to, if it doesn't work and you're not willing to tweak your offer, which it's amazing, a lot of people don't. They just sort of say, I have one offer and this is it. You know, and they don't, you know, they don't have the ability or the resources to do the testing. It makes a huge difference. Another thing that's very interesting is a lot of the clients that I spend big money for, and this has always been the case, and I see with a lot of clients that are, you know, spend millions of dollars a month on media, their business model is set up in such a way that they don't make money. They do not break even on day one from the advertising. Advertising is primarily, you know, for lead generation, and they understand their metrics and their back end and their funnel well enough to know that, hey, if I spend $1,000 and I only make back $700, I know I'm going to make $1,500 by day 30 and, you know, $2,000 by day 90. And, you know, so I'm willing to take a small loss in the front end, you know, to generate leads and make money on the back end. And so, you know, they're the ones who can scale big because they know their metrics, whereas other people who don't know their metrics go in and go, I spent $1,000, I only made $700, I lost money, it didn't work. And they walk away not realizing that they're actually, you know, probably making more money than they think they are. They just don't understand their back end.
And then what do you recommend for tracking that all the way through?
You know, it's really interesting. There isn't one tool that's best. Everybody I work with uses different tools. Some of them are custom built. Some of them are affiliate tracking software. Some of them are their shopping carts. It's various analytic programs on top of that. You know, Google Analytics is very good. If you know how to use it, there's a billion other analytics tools. And so I can't really recommend one. You need something, however that works for your business. And a lot of people already have things in place, so they have to find something that works with whatever they're using, you know, for their shopping cart or their system, and it varies from, you know, very manually created kind of systems to very automated.
Okay. Well, let's cover one more part that, you know, you mentioned about finding the, I forgot the word that you used, but the adjacent traffic sources.
Oh, lateral.
Lateral, thank you. How, you know, when we get into that, and that really does seem like the secret sauce, the crazy competitive advantage that we can find out. How do you think about finding lateral traffic sources?
So there's two ways to do it that are pretty simple. One is anybody who's doing Google content network or display traffic, you know, you can easily look in your reporting on Google and see what sites are delivering that traffic and where your conversions are coming from. And very often you'll get clues like, wow, you know, this various sites, because Google's algorithm decided to place your ads there, put this site into your campaign, and maybe it's not, you know, anything to do with your category or something that you would have targeted, but it's converting, and you go, oh, wow, well, maybe there's some other sites like it. Let me go out there and try to find some more and target that whole niche. And so at the simplest level, you can do this right with your Google campaigns. There's also tools out there. I don't know if you know Mike Colella. Mm-hmm. He's a friend of mine, and he's got a great competitive intelligence software tool called AdBeat. It basically pulls data on Google and a bunch of other networks and where people are advertising and what they're, you know, what sites they're advertising on and what they're doing. And it's, you know, it gives you clues for your own campaign. So, for example, I was watching Mike once show a guy how his tool worked, and the guy was in the debt market. And so he said, well, you know, give me your site, give me your competitor sites, let's see what everybody's doing in this market. Now, obviously, someone in the debt market is going to target debt-related keywords and, you know, et cetera.
Right.
But what he discovered was that one of his competitors was advertising on a bunch of lottery sites. And he said, lottery sites? That's really strange. Why are these people advertising on lottery sites? Well, wait a minute. I guess people who are in debt play the lottery.
Yeah.
Right? And he was like, oh, wow, that's a big light bulb went off, like, wow, maybe I should go do that too. And I guarantee you that the competition and the cost per click on lottery sites is much less than it is in the debt category. So if you can find the right people and convert them on a cheaper, on cheaper sites like lottery sites, you it's a big win. And so you could build a whole campaign around lottery sites, and then you find another clue just like that, and you build a whole campaign around the next thing. And eventually you just keep building these sort of lateral campaigns that have nothing to do with debt, but are, you know, but work. And, you know, and then, and so, you know, you can do that and then same thing. And then you might say, well, not just Google, but okay, well, maybe I can go do some direct deals with lottery sites, or maybe I find another network that's got a bunch of lottery sites in their network, you know, and you just keep, expanding laterally to reach those kind of sites or that kind of market because of that initial, you know, proof of concept you got from your Google campaign.
That's awesome. That's really cool. That's called AdBeat.
AdBeat is one of the tools. There's other things like it out there, but I highly recommend it if you're buying lots of media and you need to you want to sort of get some clues before you start your campaigns. It's a brilliant tool. I use it all the time.
Nice. Okay, well, let's transition into kind of the other three, other two main parts of our Maverick DNA here, and the second one is have more fun, or you know, live your life, not just do your business 24/7. What's your philosophy on that, and how do you practice that, and what do you do, Drew?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, was it 10 years ago? I was had a corporate job and working for a big internet site that I was basically on a plane every week, and I was selling media to big high tech companies like Hewlett Packard and Microsoft and Oracle and that kind of stuff. And I had a good job and I made a good paycheck. I had 2 weeks vacation a year, and I felt like I was owned by that company. And
right.
And when the .com crash happened, everything went south, and the company was, even though we were generating $25 million in revenue, we were losing money, and so the higher ups in London decided to let 52 of 72 people go, and in one day, and I was included in that shaving of the executive team, and I decided at that moment, do I want to go get another corporate job, or do I want to start my own thing? I was just getting ready to start a family, and I said, I don't want to be limited. I don't know where, when and where I can take vacations and how much money I can make and, where I've got to be every day. And I decided it was time to be my own boss and become an entrepreneur. And, 10 years later, I've created that lifestyle for myself. I was influenced by Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about, even if you're an entrepreneur, there's different levels of freedom that you get. If you're a professional, if you're in your own business, but you're a doctor or a lawyer, you still, you are the business, and however many hours you work or is how much money you can make, and you're still sort of limited when you go on vacation, the business is closed. And how do I create a business that's, that makes money whether you're working 9 to 5 or not? And a lot of this, advertising stuff you can do any time of day or night. It doesn't have to be, at 8 in the morning. It could be, at 11 o'clock at night. And so now I take, at least 6 weeks vacation a year with my family, travel all over the world. When I take my kids to school a couple days a week, if I need to cut out early, I've got the freedom with my schedule to live any way I like. And that's really, I basically have created that lifestyle of freedom. And that includes, fun, whatever interests that you want to pursue, whatever your hobbies are, whether it's your family or it's, it's hockey or whatever, you've got the freedom to do that. You're not limited by,
And so that was a very conscious choice. And how do you make sure that, because we all have an endless to-do list, and how do you make sure that the business doesn't encroach on what you want as your ideal lifestyle?
I'm not perfect, and I probably could have take advantage of the lifestyle even more. But like many entrepreneurs, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and I tend to balance that by working a lot late at night when the world's asleep, and I get a lot done at night so that I have more freedom during the day. If I want to take my son to hockey practice or go, take my kids to breakfast before school or whatever it is.
Right.
But, I've got the, for me, I'm a very family-oriented guy. A lot of my, free time is oriented around doing stuff with my family. But, and that's also important to me. I don't want to be that dad who comes home from his, I didn't want to be that dad who came home from his job, and had half an hour with his kids before they went to bed and only saw them, half an hour a day.
Right.
I work from home. I see my kids all the time, and I get to enjoy, watching them grow up and be a part of their lives. And that was, is more important to me almost than anything. So,
I think that's perfect. I mean, literally, even today is a perfect example, right? You mentioned hockey. So my boy Zach is almost six now, but he's been playing, and they have a session during the day called Stick and Puck, where you can mm-hmm. just go to the rink and for the kids, they need their full equipment, but I can just show up with my gloves and a helmet and so forth. And but it's at 2:45, which is most people are working,
right?
Right. But Zach absolutely loves it, and so at least once a week, we'll go to the stick and puck session. I think we're going to take them today,
awesome.
Which is during the day, and there's five people there instead of 30 people normally, or 25 people on a weekend or something like that. And it's And you know, I can really see where it makes a difference, because I've started doing this thing where I ask him every single night before bed. I'm like, "What's your three favorite things from the day?" Just to build up his confidence and, you know, get him thinking about the positive things that happen. And every time we do it, and he's always saying, you know, hockey, stick and puck, or whatever we did together, even if it was like playing street hockey outside for a half hour.
Interesting.
And so it makes a big difference.
It does, and interesting. I actually play a similar game. I call it the gratitude game. And instead of asking what his three favorite things are, I say what three things are you grateful for?
Yeah,
that happened during the day. You know, and grateful for my family, or grateful for this that happened at school, or et cetera. It's a similar.
Yeah, that's a great game. I don't know if he can understand the concept of grateful yet, but it makes total sense. And that's what we're trying to get him to do and think about. Is that,
that's awesome.
That confidence booster, the, you know, appreciating what you have kind of thing, and it's great. It's a great little thing to do for sure every night. Okay, well, anything else on lifestyle that would make sense, or stuff that you've learned along the way?
You know, it's just the simple things in life that make the most difference in your happiness, and so for me, it's my family. For maybe for other people, it might be, you know, owning an exotic car, or you know, living the jet-setting life, and, you know, going to Vegas. Everyone's different, but for me, it's just it's a conscious choice of saying how do you want to spend your time, and then creating that life, and so I'm, you know, I'm really just at peace and happy with the, you know, the ability to spend my time with my family, and, you know, I have, you know, I enjoy surfing, and I've got my own interests as well that I, you know, I'm able to pursue.
Next Baja trip, we're gonna stop at a couple surf spots.
sounds enticing.
Yeah, we'd have to get you back on there. All right, so let's talk about the you know, last part, which is the giving back, or the giving more, or giving forward. And I know you're a big proponent of this, and that was one of the things that, you know, I think really drew you to what we're doing with the Maverick Group, because you've been volunteering at different, I think, high schools, or with the urban inner city kids and so forth. What's your take on that, Drew?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's evolved over the years. I mean, I come from a family of philanthropists. I grew up, you know, standing out in the streets collecting, you know, cans of food outside of the supermarkets for the West Side Campaign Against Hunger in New York. My mom's really involved in philanthropies, and so I believe in giving back. But there's different ways to give. You can give your money, you can give your time, and ultimately, I've sort of done all the above. I do give, you know, I donate a bunch of money to charity. I have donated my time and energy to organizations like NIFTY, which you mentioned, which is teaches you know, underprivileged and at-risk kids about entrepreneurship.
Right.
And that was more of my time rather than my money. You know, going down to Compton and volunteering at the schools to teach kids about how to start your own business and help them write their own business plans, and that was kind of cool. And but one of the things that I you know, I've come to realize is that you know, I just enjoy helping people, and I kind of live by sort of that Zig Ziglar quote, you know, you can have everything you want in life if you just help enough other people to get what they want. And mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, I almost never say no. I'm sort of like that movie Yes Man. You know, if people ask me for help or advice, I'm always willing and able and, you know, to give it. And I'm actually surprised at how few people ever ask for help. But I feel like every day in my business and in my personal life, I'm constantly offering advice and helping people. My job is to help people scale and grow their businesses, which, you know, is giving in a way to helping them and their employees and everybody improve their lives. And so I kind of look at it as not so much as I have to be a, you know, a nonprofit philanthropist, you know, in and of itself, but that just in every way, every day, I'm trying to give what I have to share and to help people, and I can feel good about it, whether it's giving my, you know, my kid advice, or it's giving a client advice, or it's giving a friend advice about how to, you know, start an internet business or something like that. That, to me, that's part of my giving portfolio. And as long as I'm giving and helping in some way, whether it's my money or my time or you know, advice, that you know, I can feel good about what I'm doing, and it's not just selfish and all about me and all about money. It's I'm an open book, and I'm happy to share.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great just way of looking at it. It's not just that you have to give the money or you have to do one thing or another, but it's almost in kind of is part of your everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I saw Richard Branson speak at one of Joe Polish's events, and someone had got up and asked about, saying, hey, he really wanted to give and make a difference, but he didn't have, you know, he wasn't making a lot of money, and he sees how Branson gives in such a big way, you know, what was Branson's advice? And Branson said, you know what, your extra $50 a month isn't going to, you know, not that you shouldn't give, but, you know, giving money, in a small way, you know, isn't necessarily going to have a huge impact. If your goal is to have a huge impact, then go out and, you know, build a successful business, make lots of money, and then when you've got lots of money, you know, do something big, a couple of years from now. And I thought that was interesting. Not that you should postpone giving, but that there's different ways of giving, and if it's money that you want to give and you don't have money, then maybe, you know, you give it another way. And so for me, it took a little pressure off me. Like, I don't need to donate gazillions of dollars a year. I just need to give, you know, what I have to give. And that can be money, that can be time, that can be, you know, it's just sort of an approach to life of just being a giving person. And it always comes back. It's kind of like a karma thing. You know, the more you give, the more you get back in return. And I also learned something from Evan Pagan many years ago. Because some people feel like, you know, if you give, you got to get back. What are you getting for it? And Evan's sort of feeling was that, you know, if you give freely to 10 people, you should always give more than you ever ask for in return. And that you may give to 10 people, and maybe 7 will reciprocate, but 3 will completely take advantage and take from you and not give back. And that's okay, because it's just sort of part of the formula that not everyone's going to reciprocate. But ultimately, if you're a giver, you know, it's going to come back to you directly or indirectly, and you're going to have that reputation for being a giver, and it will, you know, help you. It'll be part of your success formula. And so I kind of agree that it's just, I give not expecting, and with one caveat. One of the things that I hate most is when you give a lot of time and energy to someone and they don't implement or execute your advice, and so. There's nothing worse than someone taking a lot of your time and then not even doing anything with it. So I definitely like to give to people who I believe are sincere and really want to learn and take advantage of what you have to share. So
yeah, that makes perfect sense, and that's great. And it's one of those things where if you're not always looking for that one for one sort of scoreboard. It makes it a lot easier to separate.
Yeah, because it really does come back. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've helped someone and then they've disappeared for a year or two, but then, you know, a year later they come back or they refer someone to you, or, you know, you end up getting some business from it. And even if you don't, it's not, I don't give to get, but it just, you know, by the nature of the laws of nature, you know, when you give, it just seems to come back. So
yeah, and like you said, you know, the giving can be in so many different ways. I mean, you know, one of the things that sort of sparked for me is the thing that I typically always do is sort of open up my Rolodex. I have a lot of different people that I know in a lot of different ways, and you're the same way. I mean, you're a connector in so many different industries and so forth. And even that simple part, it kind of ties you in as that middle person, and then it's always about, hey, you know, isn't Drew such a great guy? And then it starts that conversation, and it's like almost you're like they're thinking about you in a different way because you're the connection point. And
yeah, I hate to refer to Evan again, but he's definitely one of my, you know, biggest influences and mentors. Is he has a concept, I think he calls it, be the hub.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're the hub, you know, people always rely on you, then or come to you because you're the information source. That ultimately, it you know, when you're the hub, it benefits you, and so thinking of yourself as a connector and the hub, and when people ask for advice or referrals or recommendations, if you're always willing and able to connect them, help them, be the hub, you end up sort of being the go-to guy, and again, directly or indirectly, it comes back to you. So,
yeah, and I kind of stumbled onto that when we first started doing kind of our underground seminars, is that sort of became the hub and the spot for internet marketers to connect, and And then it was just something that I naturally did anyway, and it just turned out more beneficial than I could have ever imagined, just from the offshoots and the byproducts that come from that sort of thing.
That's exactly it. You stepped up, raised your hand, said, "I'm going to create this event," you know, and you become the hub. Your event is still my favorite internet marketing event of any event that I go to on a yearly basis. It's the best people. It's the best information. It's the least heavy pitch. It's just a real, genuine, great place for smart, successful people to meet. And so when I and other people go to this event and have a great experience every year, who benefits? Well, Yannick is the hub. Yannick created it. Yannick's the king, the castle. And so all that good energy and all that success and everything that everyone does when they go there, ultimately reflects on you because you created it and continue to have the event. So, yeah,
It's like one of those byproducts that I never even thought about when I was creating. I'm like, well, let's put on a really great event, and that's what happens. And I think people can take that concept and apply it in their own world too, in a giving fashion, and becoming that hub, and even even putting on networking or social events that Maverick is a perfect example of that too, right? We bring together these really incredible entrepreneurs, and that becomes another hub, and it's just
you're absolutely right. And in fact, creating that's something that someone who's listening to this or reading this interview can do in their local area is just to create a mastermind group. Just say, whether it's at their house or at a restaurant or wherever it is, that they just step up, become the hub, and say, hey, we're having an event for people, and everybody comes and they have a great time, and who gets the benefit of that? The person who's the hub. So it's a great way to build connections and raise the bar for your career.
Yeah, raise your profile and become that connection point. All right, well, I think we covered a ton of stuff. Talk about who is your ideal client right now. So you got two main companies, the Rainmaker Advertising Ventures and Cranking Media, which is with Scott Rowick. What's a good client for you, and where can people get a hold of you?
So I mentioned before we started the call, but I started this new media buying agency with Scott Rowick, who's also a fellow Maverick and is known as the $100 million man. He's bought over $100 million with the media. Add my $50 million to that, and we've done about $150 million. And over the past 20 years, we've got quite a bit of advertising experience. So it's Cranking Media, not cranky. We're cranking up your campaigns, and that you can go to crankingmedia.com and check out the. It's just a pretty simple website, but that's how you can get in touch with us. And we're looking for, we're really not looking for a gazillion clients. We're looking for, to work with a select few handpicked entrepreneurs that have really great products and have the desire to scale their business and have the tracking and the kind of product that's has the ability to scale on a mass market. I've had people come to throw money at us that maybe they don't have such great products or don't have the tracking in place. It's very hard to help people who aren't committed to media, who don't have the right tracking, who don't understand, the business models and the back end funnels. But somebody who's truly gets direct response, wants to grow their businesses, has the tracking, and understanding of their metrics in place, and has a general consumer kind of offer that can really scale in a big way, we can help. And those are the kind of clients we're looking to work with. But again, we're not dying for new clients.
You guys are very selective.
About we went on a one-off basis. If something really great or interesting comes along, we're totally open to working with new people. But we're definitely not looking to spread ourselves too thin and have a gazillion clients. We just want to work with a select few very strong businesses and help them scale significantly.
Great. Awesome. Drew, I really appreciate it. Thank you, as always. Very insightful, and if people definitely should have gotten a ton of value out of this. I was taking a bunch of notes on, especially the lateral and adjacent traffic marketing kind of idea. I mean, that right there is just killer, and I hope people apply it, and we'd love to hear what you do with it.
Awesome.
So appreciate it.
My pleasure. And anything else? You know, if there's any follow up or anyone asking any additional questions, you know, forward them my way. I'll be happy to respond to anyone and help them out. All right. Thanks, Yannick.